We just got back. We just rolled in from Merritt Island. Thank you. But we just had an awesome time down there at the conference. What? Tell you about it? Oh, dude, you don't have time. But we had an awesome time in the Lord. I'll tell you, just the Lord just ministered to us in just fantastic ways and spoke to our hearts. Everybody that was able to go down, I mean, the Lord just was able to minister to. Kern, you know, has been involved in institutional churches and stuff for many years. Has been to a lot of different pastors' conferences, and this is the first Calvary Chapel pastors' conference that he went to. And he said that when he got there, you know, there's a list of all these speakers, and he was thinking, oh no, this is going to be boring. But what did you tell me, Kern? It was the best. I'm telling you, it was just incredible. Wasn't it incredible, Brian? I mean, it was awesome. I don't know what else to say. That gets a little stupid after a while to just say, yeah, it was awesome, dude. But it was righteous. Yeah. But I'll tell you, I got fed. And the benefit to you in that is that I don't suppose you're going to be falling to sleep, at least for the next few weeks, because I'm stoked. And I'm stoked about being able to be here with you guys. I missed you so terribly. I'm so glad to be back, and I'm so glad that we can dive into His Word and do this together. So if you have your Bible, if you'll open it up to Exodus chapter 21. We're going to continue our study here in Exodus. Remember, this is the story of how God brought the Israelites out of Egypt and delivered them from their slavery. And last week, remember, we went over the famous Ten Commandments and looked at what God was revealing there in His moral righteousness that He revealed through those commandments. And we made several observations about those, and the danger is I could repeat the whole thing, so I'm not going to do that. But remember, God was revealing something to the Israelites at that time, and He's revealing it to us as well, because all of this that we see here in the Old Testament is God reintroducing Himself to a fallen people. He's revealing Himself. He's revealing His righteousness. And in the process, He's trying to wake us up into the humanity that He intended us to be. He's laying the foundations here in the Old Covenant for what is to come in the fulfillment of Jesus Christ. And so we continue on here. God is going to continue giving commands to Moses. Remember the great phenomena that was taking place on Mount Sinai, how there was a great thick cloud, and Moses is going back and forth into this cloud to get commands from the Lord, and he gets a little bit from the Lord, and the Lord sends him back down to tell the people, and he goes back up, and he's hearing this. And so now the Lord has been giving Moses these commands. We looked over those moral commands, the revelation of God's morality and His righteousness, and the 10 great commands that He gave at the outset. And now tonight we're going to move from that aspect to more of the legal system which God is going to set for Israel. In fact, just verse 1 here, let me just read that. It says, now this is God still speaking to Moses. Now these are the judgments or the ordinances which you shall set before them being the people of Israel. So what He's doing here and what we're going to be reading about in this chapter is God is setting the precedent for a legal system, a standard by which the judges that Moses is going to appoint. Remember a few chapters back how Jethro had left Uncle Jed and all those guys and come out to see Moses and saw how Moses was judging the people from morning till night. And he said, that's just too much. You know, one person shouldn't do that. So get yourself a bunch of other judges. Appoint other judges. So now we're getting a formalized law here. This is a formal judicial system that God is providing for Israel, that He Himself is going to provide for them, that Moses can instruct these judges in, and they can follow this to know how to make proper judgments. So now we're going to kind of get into this. We're going to look at these standards for this legal system. So the very first thing we're going to deal with here is an interesting subject. Let's read verses 2 through 4. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years, and the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and he's borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. All right, we'll stop right there. Here we have these general laws here, a general law concerning Hebrew slaves. And I find it very interesting that one of the first laws that deal with a judicial set of laws for the Israelites, to this people who God has just delivered out of slavery deals with how they handle their slaves of their own nation. It's a little bit mind-boggling in some ways, because you think that maybe God would say, now you see what it's like to be a slave, never have a slave. I mean, at least that's what I would think he'd say. But here, he's dealing with the fact that there will be slaves. And we'll see later on in the Old Testament how it is a person could come into slavery. And there were actually some fairly legitimate reasons why a person would go into slavery. Indentured servitude was the concept behind it. Oftentimes, it was because a person just had no money. A man would sometimes have to sell his children. We'll even see that a little later on in this. Would have to sell his children into slavery because he had no money, had no means of caring for them. So rather than let them die, rather than let them go into a situation where it was dangerous for them, he could sell them into slavery to another Hebrew, to one of his own countrymen. A man could do harm or damage, could be a thief and has no means of making restitution. He could be taken into slavery as a means of making restitution. But how curious is this? There's something that here really shows that they're set apart from the other nations around them because it's not an obligation to lifelong service. He serves for 6 years, and he says on the seventh year, he gets to go free. Whatever he came in with, he gets to go out with. You know, if he came in with nothing, then he's going to leave with nothing. But if he accumulated things, if he got married, in other words, if he established a family there while he's in the household of another man, he doesn't get to leave with the wife and the kids. They're going to have to stay there. They're still part of what this master has. So he's got to leave them behind if he's going to leave. But he does have the opportunity, does have the right to take his freedom after the end of 6 years, which, again, is revolutionary for that time period. You didn't see this sort of an ordinance developing in any other nation around them. This is strange stuff for God to be revealing to them. But look at this. This is really interesting here as we read. Let's read verses 5 and 6. But if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to the judges. He shall also bring him to the door or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and then he shall serve him forever. All right, so at the end of 6 years, this guy who's been a slave has the right to, after he's been there for 6 years, he has the right to, if he loves his master. It says there, if it's, you know, based on the goodness of his master to him, the blessings that he's provided for him, he isn't obligated to have to leave. He doesn't have to leave. He can make a commitment to this master to serve him for life. At this point, it's not a seven-year period. It's a lifelong commitment that he's going to be making. He's, in essence, coming into this man's household for good. And he's given a sign here. Going to have his ear pierced. A mark is going to be placed upon him to indicate that he belongs to this household forever. Even though he has the rights of a free man, he gives those rights up to become a servant to the one that he has a love for. This is a commitment motivated not by debt or by obligation. This is a commitment that can only be motivated by one thing, and that's love. And how curious is that? How curious is that in this society that we see here, this ancient Middle Eastern society, when all the cultures around them know nothing of this sort of a concept of motivating things by love, but see duty and obligation as one of the highest forms of achievement. Here, God is revealing something to them, and this is precious when you really think about it. Because it brings to light what Paul talked about. We could go to Romans chapter 1. You don't need to go there, but let me just read to you how Paul introduces himself in Romans chapter 1, if I can get there quick enough. I could have quoted it by the time I get here. Paul, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated to the gospel of God. The concept of a bondservant is what these laws regulate right here. A servant who's not there because of obligation or debt that's owed, who's there out of a motivation of love. Because of the blessings of his master, he's determined to be there. And that brings to light, then, we fully understand what Paul is trying to get at when we read this concept. God was indicating something at this time. He's revealing something to the Israelites. Not only is he revealing himself, but he's revealing something about his nature and what the relationship is going to be like with him. And Paul, remember, in all through Romans, you know, it helps us to even define what was going on there. Paul, in the book of Romans, goes on talking about how we're no longer slaves. We're no longer slaves to sin. We're not slaves to the power of sin. We don't belong to sin anymore, but we're free. We're free in Christ. And yet, then he turns right around, and like in chapter 6, he says, yeah, so now be a slave to Christ. Well, he goes to such great lengths to explain how we're no longer slaves, and then turns right around and says, yeah, go ahead and live as slaves for Jesus. Well, this is the point. Yeah, we're set free. We're absolutely set free by Jesus Christ through his sacrifice for us. Just like these bond servants, at the end of their 6 years, they were able to come into like a Sabbath year, a time when they could cease from those labors to that other master. But if they so chose, because of their love for this master, if they so chose to stay there and serve, they could do so. And that's the concept that God gets across to us. That's how we are able to balance the whole concept of good works in the New Testament dispensation. We live for Jesus Christ. We commit our lives to Him. We serve Him. We live as slaves to Him, but yet we're free people. We've been set free by Him, but because of our love for His blessing, for His goodness towards us, because of our love for Him, we submit ourselves to Him freely, not out of obligation, not out of duty, not because we're constrained to, because we have to, because you know, we're Christians, we've got to do this, but because we love Him, because of what He's done for us. So, that's a beautiful thing that's foreshadowing something else here in the Old Testament law. Now, we're going to kind of go into some trickier issues here a little later on in this chapter, and I was going to qualify this, and I didn't remember to. But remember that when we're looking at the Old Testament law, there's a tendency that we have sometimes that we've got to be careful about is that we look at the Old Testament law for Israel, and especially when we get here to these issues, when we're talking about, you know, God establishing a standard for the judges, standard for a legal system, we have a tendency to want to say, yeah, see, this is the way America should be. This is the way the United States should be governed. We look at this Old Testament law for Israel and say, yeah, you know, what's wrong with our nation? Why aren't we doing this? Or we look at the church sometimes and say, yeah, see, this is how the church is to be governing herself and doing these things. And we try to spiritualize these things into codes of conduct for the church. That was never God's intention. We've got to be careful about that. We live in the United States of America, and for all of its wonderful attributes, you know, I was really stoked the other night watching the president's speech, you know, cheering most of the way through it and everything. For all of its wonderful attributes, it is not the kingdom of God, and it is not Israel. These were laws designed for Israel. There's moral aspects to them that we can see and we can learn from, and I would say that the majority of our nation was built upon ideas that come from the moral truths that are found in the Word of God, but we can't look at this nation and say, yeah, this nation should be adopting this or that based on what the Old Testament says here. We're going to be getting to issues a little bit later on in this chapter that could be controversial to some people, so just qualify that in your mind. Remember, we're looking at this, and what we're looking at is God revealing Himself to the Israelites because He's paving the way for the fulfillment of the law which comes in Jesus Christ. Do I got you on that? I mean, you're not confused or anything? We understand what we're talking about. Okay, good. I don't want to go on if we're hung up on that. Okay. Let's read verses 7 through 11. We're going to deal with a woman being sold into slavery. If a man sells his daughter, verse 7, sells his daughter to be a female slave, she's not going to go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt deceitfully with her. If he's betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her according to the customs of daughters. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marriage rights. If he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. All right, now, I realize, remember, we've got to read all of this. Please remember, we're reading this from the context of American Christians in a culture that this sort of a idea is absolutely foreign. I mean, you know, the idea of selling a daughter into slavery is absurd to us. We don't understand that. But try to think like a Hebrew would in this time frame. We've got to look at the world and the culture from that perspective and realize what it was like then. And the world was a different place at that time. God didn't choose to just reveal everything at once and implant all of these things into the hearts of His people in one quick shot. He took the time that He took for whatever reasons, and I can't explain that to you because I don't know, but I'm comforted in the fact that you don't know either. But for whatever reason, God revealed it in the time that He revealed it. So please remember that as we're looking at these things, and we might look at this and think, oh my goodness, what's he talking about, selling his daughter into slavery? Well, we already pointed out the various reasons why he may have had to do that. But you notice here that she's not to be sold into a slavery to go out, in other words, go out and work in the fields and do the kind of manual labor that a man would do. In fact, mostly the idea behind it is to betroth himself. The master would betroth himself. In other words, take her on to be a future wife for himself or for his son. And so that's more or less the idea behind it. And even in that, if the guy decides not to marry her or decides not to give her to his son, then he still has to respect her rights under God's law. And I'm telling you, that right there sets Israel light years apart from its neighbors and from the surrounding cultures. This is paving way. The idea that a woman who had absolutely no place in society in that day and age, the idea that a woman was actually to be respected by God and society at large was completely foreign. You know, and of course, it's not what the New Testament will reveal. The New Testament makes it so clear. Paul tells us that the ground is level at the foot of the cross, neither Greek nor Jew, male nor female, free or slave. Everyone's equal there. The New Testament reveals that to us. Of course, you know, Christianity is always portrayed as this misogynist kind of woman-hating religion or whatever. There would be no equal rights. There would be no equality of the sexes if it weren't for the New Testament. Always remember that. There's different roles, to be sure. There's different strengths that each sex brings, but equality is guaranteed by the New Testament to us. All you have to do is look around at the other cultures. Go to Islam and look at how women are treated who have not submitted their hearts to the truths of the New Testament. You see terrible treatment of women in that kind of culture. So it was the birth of Christianity. It's the New Testament. It's what Christ revealed in his demonstrating of his love and the doctrine of grace that provides equality for women. But either way, the point is that this, you know, here's this revolutionary law that he puts in there, that there's this sense that she's to be protected and cared for. God's revealing something in the process of this, showing the kind of things that we need to value as a society. He's showing a society needs these sort of things, and these are the things that God prioritizes. We go to verses 12 through 14, and we're going to deal with a kind of a touchy situation here. He's dealing with capital punishment. Let's read what it says here. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. And he will stop there. Verse 4. I will stop at verse 14. Back in Genesis chapter 9, in verse 6, God set the precedent for this concept of capital punishment. This is after Noah and his sons have come out of the ark, and he's telling them to be fruitful and multiply the earth. But in verse 6 it says, whoever sheds a man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And so here we see God's getting a principle across here. He's getting a principle across about the importance of life. He's wanting us to see how much we need to value human life. And God qualified it there in Genesis chapter 9, or chapter 6, verse 9. It's not just life in general. It's not an environmentalist concept of, you know, oh yeah, we value all life. We don't kill bugs. We don't kill spotted owls or anything like that. No, God made a very clear distinction there. Man is made in the image of God. He bears in him the very characteristics of the God who made him. There is something very precious, very valuable about life. And it's important for us as Christians to remember that. We value life. We value life. While we don't fear death, death holds no fear for us because of what Christ did for us in rising from the dead. We know that we belong to him, we're going to him, and so there's no fear there. But while we don't fear death, we still value life. And God was trying to get that across to the Israelites, the importance of human life, the value of it, and how they needed to be a society that was protective of human life. And that's what he's getting across in this. Paul, of course, in the New Testament tells us in Romans that, I believe it's Romans 13, that the government has the power granted to it to wield the sword in cases of judicial determinations. To say that it has the power to wield the sword can't mean anything else except the idea that the government has the right granted by God to take a life if it so determines based on the punishment meted out by that government. God's given the right to the nation to do that. And we have to, of course, let the nation make those determinations in our nation here. It's determined by vote and things like that. And so we have to allow for each government to make that choice and that determination. We can't go back to the Old Testament law and say, well, see, God demanded that it happen that way. God's revealing something to the Israelites. Here, I think that the government is given that privilege and grant demand. Bizarre to me when we've got Christian groups demanding the death penalty. It's incongruous to me. We allow the government to do, and we pray for the governments, and we pray that God will allow His will to be done. I believe that God has granted the right to the government to do it, but the government's going to make that determination, and the government here is by the people, and so that's determined by the vote, and the people will do that. But so anyway, that's the point. I'm just saying there's the thing is what he's talking about in this. He's not talking about death in general. Again, remember, one of the commandments is you shall not murder. So we know that God's not just talking about, you know, that it's okay just to take a life like that based on that, but he's talking about premeditated murder. That's the whole point of this. You know, he says if the guy didn't lie in wait, but if he was handed over, delivered over by God, the point to that is not saying that, you know, if God was really ticked off at somebody and he, you know, let this guy kill him, then it's okay. That's not his point at all. He's just saying that if an accident happened, it's like insurance companies always refer to things that are acts of God. You know, it was an accident. He didn't mean to do it. It wasn't his purpose to do it. He didn't set out to do this. Then you know, it's going to be a different situation there. But if it was his determination, if he went out, if he premeditatedly went out, and made this determination, if it wasn't by something that was by providence that was beyond his control, you know, a guy has somebody work on his house and the ladder breaks and the guy, you know, falls to his death or whatever, God's saying, well, we're not going to hold him accountable to where it's a life for a life in this situation. It was an accident. This was something out of his control. Guys are fighting, you know, in a bar or whatever. A guy falls back and hits his head on the bar stool or something and he dies. It wasn't premeditated. The other guy, you know, didn't necessarily set out to try to destroy this person. It's a different situation there. If it was manslaughter, we consider that to be manslaughter. But if he premeditates it, if he's out with a determination to do violence, to bring about an end to a life, then God is clearly saying that this man is to be delivered over. He's supposed to pay the price for that. And he says there he's to be taken from the altar. In other words, you know, in that culture, and we'll see that in other times as we go through the Old Testament, we'll see that a person could go to the horns of the altar, to hold on to the horns of the altar to ask for sanctuary, even in the other cultures around them. A person could go into a temple, hold on to the altar, and consider themselves in a position of sanctuary. But God is saying, that's not going to work here. Nobody is going to find sanctuary, something like that, who does something like this in my altar. He says, I'm not going to protect him. You take him out. You take him away from my altar. It doesn't matter what you have to do or where you have to go to find him. You take him and you take him out. So what he's trying to do here, what God's trying to do for Israel is he's establishing for them the concept of a protective society, a society that values life. It's such an important thing. It's such an important thing for a society to protect life. It's so important. It's what holds a society together, and that's what God's getting across to them there. So we got to keep going here. I'm sorry. Verses 15 to 17. He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. You kidnap, this is going to be a lot of capital punishment stuff here. You kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he's found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Kids. My mom used to quote that one to me all the time. I was actually afraid to go to church because you didn't know if there was a pile of rocks out back or something like that, but well, if a child murders a parent, I really don't believe this is talking about a little child necessarily. It's talking about the idea is if you know, someone who is the offspring of a parent who takes the life of his parent. It's protecting people as they get older. The idea behind that is there's no family insulation from this. Well, this was a family squabble. You know, I had to kill my parents. It was just one of those things. It's in-house. Don't bother us. No, Jesus, God is saying to them there that there's no family insulation from this. Life is precious. Life is precious to me, he's saying. And so don't allow anyone to try to blame this on family or anything like that. He's to face the same consequences. Murder is murder. Kidnapping is considered a capital offense because really to criminally enslave a person is to do the same as to take away their life, to take away their freedom and ability to make choices for themselves and do for themselves what they desire to. And so, you know, he's establishing this concept of a protective society that is preserving human rights. And here it says, you know, if someone curses his parents. Now, before you stress or anything, you know, he's not talking about grumbling against his parents or being upset with mom and dad or something like that. He's talking about, and I believe he's, again, dealing with an adult child. He's not dealing with a little kid who's throwing a temper tantrum, but he's dealing with an adult child. And the word behind this means to threaten. If he threatens his parents And again, we see the concept here of protecting the senior. You realize, of course, that the older generation, you know, ultimately ends up at the mercy of the younger generation. God is establishing a sense of generational respect. It's got to be in place. It's a foundational thing to society. We pointed that out in the Ten Commandments, you know. He says, honor your father and mother. The idea is there's got to be this generational respect. I realize I'm only 42, but, you know, when I'm sitting there listening to my teenage son go, you know, when you die, I think this or that will happen. I'm going, when I die, what are you talking about? You know, it makes you want to sleep with an eye open or something. But you realize, I'm just kidding, but you realize as you get older, you know, I'm realizing it more and more. As we get older, we're at the mercy of the younger generation. There comes a point in time we can't do for ourselves like we were able to do for ourselves when we were young like them. And so, we're at the mercy of these rotten kids. So, yeah, here he is. No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. I say my rotten kids. I kid when I'm talking about that. If I was going to have to fall into anyone's mercy, I'd rather fall into their merciful hands than anyone else's. But the concept behind it, what? Yeah, okay. So anyway, the idea is protecting seniors here. Again, emphasizing the value of life, young or old. It doesn't matter in God's sight. The idea is the value of life. He deals with the concept of personal injury, verses 18 and 19. If men contend with each other and one strikes the other with a stone or his fist, and he dies, I guess a brick is okay, but a stone or his fist, and he does not die but is confined to his bed, if he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, that doesn't mean a group of people, that means his walking stick, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. And so, here again, we got compensation for personal injury. If a guy hits another dude and they're in a fight or whatever, and the guy's bedridden because of it, the guy who did the hitting is going to be liable for compensating him for his loss, the loss of time from work, the loss of time from his crops or whatever. But it says if the hitter is acquitted, he's not going to be held responsible. It's going to be life for life if the guy, you know, is okay, if he gets over it, if he heals up and he's able to move around, even if he's able to walk around with a stick, he's still going to have to compensate. And that's emphasizing the concept of fairness, of taking care of, you know, being accountable for our deeds and our actions. Our society really is run a lot like this. I mean, that's the whole concept there. We've got, the problem with it in our society is that we've abused it so badly. I mean, that's how we've got, you know, McDonald's having to give out whatever million-dollar settlement to a woman. Wasn't it a woman who, you know, burned herself because coffee's hot, you know? You can't have ever drunk coffee in your life if you don't know how to drink a cup of coffee. You never just go up and slurp coffee. It doesn't matter how long it's been sitting there. I never do. It could be ice cold, and I'm... I mean, just grab a cup of coffee... That's insane to me. And yet, now, have you ever looked at McDonald's coffee? It has a little warning label on that. Have you noticed that? Caution. Coffee is hot. Okay. It's crazy. But we've turned it into a joke in our nation, but the concept behind it, the underlying principle, was the idea of fair compensation. You injure someone, something is, you know, you're responsible for the injury of someone, then you take care of that. You're responsible. Be responsible for those sort of things. Verses 20 to 21 get a little bit more perplexing. If a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive,